to tell you a story about black hole entropy. Of course, these things have been investigated in string theory for quite a long time. I will take a somewhat simplified view. I will take a very ambitious view that then, unfortunately, will not be very precise. So I'll take a very big picture kind of view of where I think the whole thing is going, should be going, and then I'll give some evidence for that picture basically being the right picture and one that one should develop. But there will be big holes, and there will be cranky comments, and that's wonderful. Do discuss. So what's my idea? Well, the big picture I'll start with is basically what I'd call the phenomenology of black hole entropy. So I'll start going backwards, not a word of strings, not a word of microscopics. Just look at what is the answer we're trying to understand. And from the answer, there's the famous strategy known as an answer analysis that one can try to say, well, wonder where that could come from. So this will be sort of a good part of the discussion. Then in order to try to firm up the phenomenology I will have built up by that time, I will try to show you thermodynamics, just black hole thermodynamics, but not the by-the-book thermodynamics. That's something that's organized in a very different way. And it's a different way that I think will help supporting the picture that I have. And the picture I have is that there should be something like a conformal symmetry similar to what we know from ADS-CFT, but it should apply to every single black hole in the kind of general class that I'm looking at. And we have some references here. Oh, oops, I thought I had looked that up. I don't know where I put it in. Anyway, it was out. So, so it's a bunch of papers, including very old papers, but also some new work within the last half year. So what's the idea? Well, what's the setting, first of all? Well, I'm going to have in mind that we look at very general black holes. For now, I'm just going to think about that we're on N equal 2 string theory or some such thing. And I'm going to think that they're described somehow by 2D CFTs, the way that at least the extremal black holes in this context would be. So the guiding assumption is that such a dual CFT would work very generally. By very generally, I'm emphasizing that I have in mind even Kerr black holes, Schwarzschild black holes, and black holes that are also general enough that they have a lot of charges and stuff, so that I could still go to the BPS and near BPS limit and see that the story I'm trying to sell you does in fact reduce to a story that you would say, oh yeah, that story at least is correct. So unlike Kerr CFT, for example, where one is starting with a new story and tries to then perhaps understand what things are going on in that corner, I would like to try to understand things everywhere in such a manner that the things that we actually already did understand is a subset. So that's the strategy. Now, since that's a very ambitious strategy, I will tone down a little bit, and that'll still be more than plentiful to talk about, and say that what I would like to do is to just talk about the semi-classical kind of conformal symmetry, akin to the sort of thing that one has gotten by using the Brown-Hinault formula to try to understand the central charge and the entropy of black holes, of the BTC black holes. So it's not a very detailed understanding, but it's pretty solid. It's that kind of thing that I would like to try to understand in this more general context. So I would like, for example, to think that we can identify the central charge and the temperature, and we can account, quote unquote, for the black hole entropy, but at least with providing some details that were not obvious before we start. Now, I should say that I'm not trying to just play a game here to just lower the bar. I definitely have in mind that one should do a precise counting of the black hole microstates. The outline I have in mind, and that I mimic my considerations to try to support, is to say that the BPS kind of sectors that we do know how to count, they're counted by a very complicated type of partition functions, some automorphic forms that you can think about as multi-string partition functions. My thinking is that what you should do is to take multi-string partition functions like that, and you should, roughly speaking, square them. The way you do with a single-string partition function is that you find a holomorphic one, you find an anti-holomorphic one, and you multiply them. And then there's a little business, of course, of making sure you get a full modular orbit and whatnot, and it's that little business that I surely would like to provide you some details on down here, and is that which I'm not going to mention at all any further. So that's why I'm saying, look, let me be ambitious, but not ridiculous. So what's the phenomenology? Well, let's start with Kerr, because this is something that people would know of, even if they've never looked at black holes, if they looked at any kind of beginning of GR. What's the entropy of a Kerr black hole? Well, this is the entropy of the Kerr black hole. And then any reasonable person who have ever looked at Cardy's formula will say that it's pretty obvious that this falls in two pieces, this piece and that piece. And the way you should think about it is that this, you see, is from one side of the conformal field theory, let's call it left, and this is from the other side, let's call it right, and clearly the left and right, they do not interact very much, and that's why you can add up the entropies. So that's a basic part of my phenomenology. It's not exactly novel, and it's entirely unsupported, but this is nevertheless a piece that I'm trying to push. So if this is the right interpretation, let's go with it for a second, then we can say, okay, now I know the entropy of the left movers and the right movers separately, so a little bit more information than I had a priori. So I can write down a law of thermodynamics, a first law of thermodynamics, black hole thermodynamics, for the left and right movers independently. So I can define a left temperature and a right temperature separately by basically asking the left movers, how good are they at carrying energy? The right movers, how good are they at carrying energy? And then, of course, since the overall energy is the overall energy, the actual Hawking temperature, the inverse Hawking temperature, is just the sum of these two betas. But I have a little bit more data once I take this phenomenological interpretation and say, let's see how far it can bring us, this very naive interpretation. Well, one place it can bring us is that it does kind of nicely, automatically, actually give me a model for where angular momentum comes in the game. Because my thinking is that this theory, just like the BPS theories that I actually like, there should be an underlying CFT. It has right movers and left movers. But in particular, it should have some right movers that might be a supersymmetric theory. This I know because there is a supersymmetric limit, after all. So therefore, if I go to the chiral limit, it should be supersymmetric. So I'm thinking that the right moving sector really should be supersymmetric. In fact, it might be an n equal 4 supersymmetric theory, because that's what happens at the n equal in the extreme limit. Is that, and here I just added on this extra piece that I don't know much about, but I'm still having the same right movers as I would have at the extremal limit. This means that I know that I have an R symmetry, an issue 2 R symmetry. I know that I have quantum numbers with respect to that issue 2 R symmetry, and I know that they're all taken into account just by spectral flow. So it's extremely simple. So in that way, I can sort of understand, quote unquote, why does the angular momentum enter in exactly that way? Well, you see the right movers, they have some energy, and then some energy is wasted in carrying angular momentum. And that's why this domain is J squared. And that's exactly what we know from, for example, the BMPV black hole. That is exactly how it works. What I'm adding on to is to proposing that, well, you see, now this is the other side. But the other side, since it doesn't have a supersymmetry, it doesn't care about angular momentum. And therefore, it's only this side that we actually know about already that carries angular momentum. So we can understand, if you wish, how the angular momentum appears. Of course, I'm really reverse engineering here and using the way J was appearing as inspiration for proposing the story, but I'm going to tell the story in the opposite way around. And then by the end of the talk, you can start reading the slides backwards and say, ah, that's where he came from. But I'm going to try to explain things as if I'm really, really smart and just making it up as we go and doing it phenomenologically. So this was 4D black holes. I'm not going to say much about 5D black holes, but obviously they have two angular momenta, and I have in mind that there was a 4,4 superconformal field theory for those, so you have an SU2 cross SU2 R symmetry, and everything will work just the way it does that we know in the actual string theory examples that we understand. So where do we go? Do we know anything more now? Well, one thing we do know is that I was telling you that the right entropy and the left entropy should sort of be understood in terms of this gas that was living, right-moving gas, left-moving gas, that has separate temperatures. I actually know what those temperatures are, because I told you that I could find them from the first law of thermodynamics. There's a small little confusion, which is that those temperatures I find from the first law of thermodynamics are actual temperatures, as in they have dimension of energy, give and take a Boltzmann constant, whereas the temperature that we're familiar with from CFT, which are kind of dimensionless. The CFT doesn't have a scale, you know, it's just, that's what the C stands for. It's conformal. Therefore, it has dimensionless temperatures usually. So we need some kind of factor that is saying this scale is what? Well, I give it a name. It's called R, that the 1D gas that lives on a circle that has radius R. And I would like to know what that R is. Regrettably, my answer analysis is not powerful enough. But it is powerful enough to understand not what the central charge is or what that circle size is, but the product of the two. At least I can understand that. What's the product of those two from phenomenology? At this point, I get a modest encouragement to my bold phenomenological analysis that the right movers and left movers give the same value for C times R. And that's nice, because if the central charge had been already at this level different on the right and left-hand side, I would have had a conformal anomaly, a gravitational anomaly somewhere. And that's OK with me at the h-bar level, but it's not OK with me at the semi-classical level. So I'm really hoping that I'll get the same right charge and left central charge. And it appears as if I'm on a good setting here. The central charge is, roughly speaking, cubed in the energy. We know this from the extremal limits where it's cubic in the charges, but at this point, I do not have any charges. I just have the only parameter I have around is the mass, because the angular momentum I've taken into account by spectral flow. All right, so this is encouraging, and this was what I just said. So let me go on. Now, I was kind of joking with you that I said there was a formula. Clearly, that formula for the Kerr black hole entropy looked like one piece plus another. But you know, if you have a formula for something, there are actually many ways you could split it into two pieces. You don't have to eyeball it and saying, well, of course, this is the way, and well, that was the simplest way. But you can ask, this way that really offers itself, what does it mean? What does it mean? Well, one way to ask that is to say, okay, the entropy is, of course, the right movers plus left moving entropy. What's the left moving entropy minus the right moving entropy? Well, that's sort of saying, what's the split? Well, I can't really tell you what it is, but I can give you a geometrical interpretation that is, I think, coming to vogue again. The geometric interpretation is that the difference you should get if somebody gives you a solution and you find the entropy and you say, but I would really like to split into two pieces. It's kind of complicated. I don't know how. Well, compute the area as you would have normally, except compute the area not of the outer horizon, compute it of the inner horizon. This way you get something else. In fact, what you would get in the Kerr case is that you would get an inner area that looked like the m squared. Instead of looking like m squared plus square root of stuff, it's m squared minus square root of stuff. So what I'm saying is that the unique way you should go about splitting such complicated formulae into two pieces is by computing the inner area. And this works really well. For example, if you take amazingly complicated things like black rings and five dimensions with multiple horizons and stuff like that, you might not know how to split it into two pieces. But it turns out that if you use this rule here, you actually find a very nice split. So therefore, this has been used sort of as a black box rule. Yeah? Well, in Schwarzschild, the two sides have the same entropy, and that's because the inner area, quote unquote, is zero. It's been squeezed into the singularity. So therefore, for Schwarzschild, it's a bad special case in that indeed the right and left movers are not conspicuous. The entropy formula doesn't look like something plus something else. The two sides are going to be the same. So there, you would be unimpressed when I said, oh, m squared. Oh, yeah, that's half m squared plus half m squared. And this you would have to agree with, but you would be unimpressed.
Just seems that you need it more than one horizon, but okay, you say. All right, fine.
Schwarzschild is the only one where I don't have this, and it's a degenerate limit. Yeah?
Are you going to talk about the instability of the inner horizon later? Or?
Absolutely not. and I don't think it matters because I'm not thinking about there actually being physics stuff happening in here. Note that what I'm saying is that I take my full entropy, split it into two pieces, but if I try to say that there's a thermodynamics for the outer area and a separate one for the inner area, I'd be in trouble for exactly the reason that you're talking about. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there are two different thermodynamic laws near the outer horizon. They're independent. And somehow they know about the inner horizon. I'm imagining that there's some kind of instanton that connects them or something like that, but this I do not know.
But the naive inner horizon before we take into account quantum back reaction.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. That's the error. The error if that is semi-classical, you know. So it's great. Look, this has come up a lot. This part, the inner area part, I've talked about for 15 years. And Gibbons has been giving him such a hard time. And it's a wonderful victory that he started writing papers on the inner horizon using just this perspective. So it might fly. You know, once he stops giving me a hard time, it counts for something. Not everything, you know. And hey, it might be wrong, but at least it's interesting. So what happened now? Okay. Right. Now, see, I can find another piece of evidence with this inner horizon business. Don't think about it in space-time. Just tell me here that I'm trying to tell you how to construct a CFT. There's a really, really interesting sum rule that's related to this inner horizon rule, which is that if you take the inner horizon area and basically multiply it by the outer horizon area, what I'm claiming is that that gives always an integer in the Born-Sommerfeld way. I can basically check this when it comes to this formula I wrote for the entropy that had one piece m squared, another piece m fourth minus j squared, but with a square root. What I'm saying is that if I took the square of the first term minus the square of the second term, then all the complicated stuff, the m squared, cancels. And all I'm left with is j. And j I know how to quantize. It turns out that this rule that appears to be valid even for enormously complicated black ring solutions and others, where in fact they never give us enough of the metric to even tell us what the inner area is. But we checked it now in a bunch of cases, and this rule appears to hold in all cases that I'm aware of, that if you take the inner product, inner area plus times the outer area, you get something that appears to be just an integer. If you have many charges, many dipole charges, stuff like that, the right-hand side is much more complicated, but is always an integer. This is very important because this is exactly what you would expect if the underlying CFT, which of course was just a guess, but if that underlying CFT has a level matching rule, that you can be at whatever energy you want on the right, you can be at whatever energy you want on the left, but the difference has to be an integer. This is what string theories do. So there's a connection between the two sides. Yeah? Yes. I do not know how to make it precise, but in the sense of Born-Sommerfeld, by that I mean to say that I think there could actually be a plus half on the other side, just not something that depends on all the moduli. Something that, I mean, what is strange here is that if you had the charges, if you had complicated stuff, this is why I should have plugged it in. I forgot the cable. So that's all there is to it, is that I'm saying that I know, in fact, if I do the corresponding thing here in the near BPS limits, there will be quantum corrections on the right-hand side, but those will not be moduli dependent, even when we're far off extremality. So let me show you an example, in fact, like that. Let's take sort of a more complicated context, not just pure Kerr, but let's take some black holes with a lot of charges, like an N=4 supergravity, N=8 supergravity, or some such thing. To write the black holes in this case is tremendously complicated, right? All the matter, stuff like that. So I'm not going to really show it to you. I am going to remind you that a good way of writing these things is in terms of not the masses and the charges, but in terms of certain parametric masses and parametric charges. The little m is in one-to-one correspondence with the actual physical mass, big M, but it's a length. And it's not exactly the mass. And the little deltas here, the boost parameters, so-called, are in one-to-one correspondence with the physical charges, and the A parameter here, which of course is really just the angular momentum per mass unit that we know from the Kerr black hole, but once we have charges, that too get dressed in some complicated way. And here there's some abbreviations, pi C, pi S are the product of all these cautions. So this is a very complicated formula for the mass and charges. The metric can be written in just one page in terms of the deltas and M's, and then after that you might imagine inverting these, and I do not recommend that you try to do that. This is the way to present things. So what's the entropy? Well, the entropy nicely falls into two pieces, even when we add all the charges. A piece on the right-hand side, the left-hand side is effectively just m squared, but dressed up with the charges somehow. And the right-hand side is effectively just, again now, the mass to the fourth minus j squared, but with the mass again renormalized somehow due to all the charges. So this is the formula that if you go to the extremal limit, people get a lot of mileage out of, the square root of a product of four integers. But what you should notice now is that it's very, very complicated. The one thing that you see that's very encouraging already at this spot is that you see that, oh yeah, this minus j squared here, the j is still accounted for by this rule of spectral flow. So that's very encouraging. But the other thing that's less evident is that I still have my quantization rule on the inner area. I do not know, and I still do not know exactly what it means, but I interpret it microscopically in a very attractive way that's really just in terms of a level matching condition, which I think is a very good way of interpreting it. But at this level, I can also say, let me just try to be a general relativist who's checking some quantization rule I've been given and just wondering if it's still true. Let me take basically the actual area times the inner area. That corresponds to taking the square of the first minus the square of the second. Again, clearly, my j squared is being popped out. But what is not so clear is that all the rest here, some combinations of all the boost angles, delta, all the m's, exactly come in the combination of the product of the four physical charges. And the four physical charges I can rewrite, in fact, in terms of integral charges. So in this way, I get the j4 integral symbol on the right-hand side. This is not obvious at all. Because in general, if I just took one area and multiplied by another area, I'd get some stuff that depends in very complicated ways on moduli. There are all these charges around, after all, the physical charges that depends on the moduli. But here all the moduli, they cancel out, and I get everything is just a bunch of integers with a constant 1 in front, in such a way that this really is an integral number. It's that sort of thing that makes me feel that somehow there's something right about this. It surely isn't fully developed. I told you from the beginning, this would be speculative, provocative, and all that, not fully justified. But the reason I find it worth talking about is that there's something right about this. It's not clear that if you took these two pieces here, the inner area and the outer area, and multiplied them, they should give an integer. But if there's an underlying CFT, you have with a level matching condition, the way we have in string theory, then it is true. Then this is what you would expect. So the fact that it happens gives you some evidence, an encouragement, that in fact, maybe it's true. In particular, you can also now work your way back. You can find your back, work your way back, find out what is the central charge. Central charge is no longer m cubed. It's somehow m cubed, dressed up with the charges. If you go to the extremal limit, this is literally just the product of three integers, 6 and 1 and 2 and 3. But in general, this is, of course, a much more complicated expression. And I'm proposing that as somehow being the one that should underlie the CFT of this general black hole, and have at least a little bit of evidence to support that view. So I'm going to start with the actual geometries now. You can see why I started with the big words. If I'd started looking at this and just stared at it, I'd say, what am I supposed to look for? This is very complicated. This is a tremendously complicated metric. This is the rotating black hole in four dimensions, but not just a Kerr black hole. It's a Kerr black hole with those four charges turned on. That's why it looks kind of complicated. Kerr itself is pretty complicated. So even if you don't have the charges, it wouldn't be a lot simpler than this. I've written it in a way that's not the textbook way of writing Kerr, but it's very similar. I've written it in the way where I've said that dt has some kind of shift along phi because I have rotation. So this is the potential that basically couples to rotation. But I have only one cross term in dt d phi. Sometimes when people write it in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, they decide to have two different cross terms. It's quite important for me that I've written it in exactly this way with just one of the cross terms. But this will become clear in a second. Then I have a whole bunch of functions. In order to write the whole metric in just one line, I had to introduce a bunch of abbreviations. There was this potential here, a phi, basically a one form with some stuff that looks complicated. Then I have some metric, some x. X is nice in that that's just a little bit less complicated. Just depends on r. Doesn't depend on the polar angle. So they didn't get deformed by the rotation. So x is kind of nice. G here is something that, well, it has some theta dependence, but at least it's related to the x by some pretty simple thing. And this, then, is manageable. And then there's delta. Oh my god. This thing here, in front of the dt part, a total and absolutely impenetrable mess. And the opposite of that in front of all the spatial pieces here. Total impenetrable mess. So what are we going to make of this? Can we make sense of this? Well, a good place to start is to look not at the metric, but look at the Laplacian. I have in mind looking, for example, at a massless scalar field propagating in this geometry to see what does it do. Well, the scalar wave equation gives us some evidence here that will point us towards a dual CFT as well. So what's the Laplacian? Well, for that, I have to write the inverse of the metric. It's actually a little bit complicated finding the inverse. I know it's a principle, of course, just a 4x4 geometry. Take the inverse, but you know the entries were kind of big. And if you give this to Mabel, it'll put garbage out. So you actually have to organize your thoughts. But all right, once you've organized your thoughts, you find that the general Laplacian is not that bad. This is what it looks like. It still fits on one line. Of course, it's in part because I cheat, because I still have my delta that I didn't actually tell you what. I mean, I told you what it was, but you've forgotten. And the x's and the g's and the a. Now it's an a reduced. I took the sine squared theta out. So this is just the r dependence sitting in the potential. So it's totally complicated. But still, there is something nice about this, even in the totally general case. What is nice about it is the Kerr black holes, as you may recall, they allow separation of variables. These general black holes now that have a lot of charges and stuff, one would have thought generically that maybe the separation of variables was just some kind of accident because we don't really understand why it's true for Kerr. I mean, we have words such as Killing-Yano tensor and some such thing that imply separability, and therefore it somehow is explaining it, but it doesn't really explain it in a physical term. Why should we expect it to be separable? I don't know. But what I do know is that I can ask myself, is this thing here separable? Well, it's a good start. This here depends on only R. This here depends on only R, because this is the R-dependent part of the azimuthal angle. This one here is also depending on only R. This one here depends on only R. Then this term here is the angle of Laplacian. It's even spherical. It's even the spherical Laplacian. The only place it's complicated is here. This mixes the polar angles and R in a very complicated way. But now when you put in the actual A, that was kind of complicated, minus the actual delta, which is very complicated, then it'll give something that just happened to factor out the G, which is also pretty complicated. And it doesn't just factor it out. It gives something that depends on R plus something that depends on theta. So this thing here does, in fact, separate variables. What does it mean? I don't really know, but I like it. It means that I can simplify things. In fact, things are a little bit better than just separation of variables. If I look at this radial equation I get now, it's not just any radial equation. It's something that's awfully close to the hypergeometric equation. Even in the totally general case, I get a radial equation. Mathematically speaking, what I have is two singularities, two regular singularities, mathematically speaking, which means that I can solve them by R to some power locally and try to patch it together. And I can figure out which power. These are not just two regular singularities at any place. One is at the inner horizon and one is at the outer horizon. So the propagation of fields in this background tell me that the two special spots, inner horizon and outer horizon, and they are on equal footing. Since these are regular singularities, I can devise a symmetry at the level of this equation that interchanges the two. The indices, indeed, of these two singularities are basically the Hawking temperature and then this right Hawking temperature and the left Hawking temperature. So these are the indices of the singularity. The only fly in the ointment here is that if I wanted a hypergeometric equation, I really would like a third regular singularity. I do have a third singularity, it's at infinity actually, as these singularities often are, but it's too dramatic. Basically because my delta is the one that, if this thing was not rotating, would be pretty much the product of the four harmonic functions multiplied by R4. So the R plus a charge, whole thing to the fourth. Something that at any rate goes like R to the fourth at infinity. R to the fourth is too strong. It's too strong at infinity. I need my R to the fourth in order for this entire geometry approaching flat space. But I'm led to think that since I like mathematical niceties and I think it somehow means something, I would really hoping that this delta here would go like R squared instead. Why? Because if it did, I would have a regular singularity even at infinity. So if the delta was not what it actually was, but instead something that went like R squared at infinity, there would in fact be a full SL2 symmetry that permutes the three singularities. And in fact, my scalar equation would basically be the Casimir of that SL2. And as everybody knows, once you have an SL2, it follows that you have a Virasoro algebra. No, that's not true. But this is something that has been claimed in various papers, so I thought I would try. But nevertheless, if you have an SL2, you can hope you have a Virasoro. It's a very good start. If you didn't have an SL2, in fact, you will not have a Virasoro. So therefore, at least it's something to have an SL2. It's something if you hope to find a Virasoro somewhere. It's a good start to have found an SL2. But you will not find an SL2 in the entire geometry. You only find it somehow in a geometry where the delta is not the actual delta. It's another delta. But all the other functions are what they actually should be. R equals 0 is not special. R equal the inner horizon, R equal R plus, R equal R minus are special, R equals 0 is not special. I could shift it and there's no singularity there in the scalar wave equation.
If it was asymptotically ADS, would this story change?
No, I don't think so.
Don't you generically get force into the points?
You may be right.
Generically you get Hoyne functions, right?
You may be right. At least, no, I think they're right. I think you're right. You have four singularities. That's right. I think they're right. But I'm not an ADS.
You said that's special to ADS.
Yeah, I think so. In this aspect, flat space is simple. Yeah, that's right. But I think you're right. There's a paper, actually, by Swedish and Gibbons that did just that. I think they're four singularities, not three. Also, if you put it in this iter, for example, instead. Which, I mean, please don't do that. I can keep mine on one transparency. But In fact, I would like to be more ambitious. If delta goes like r squared infinity, I would get my SL2 symmetry. But I still would get a Laplacian that somehow deforms my spherical symmetry. If I somehow, for whatever reason, had a delta that just went like proportional to r, then in fact, I would simply get an r symmetry, an SU2 r symmetry. And that's the sort of thing that I'm thinking I should have, because I think that my angular momentum dependence of the entropy is basically means that I'm deserving of getting a full SU2 r symmetry. And therefore, I have to find where is the sphere. And I will have found the sphere if indeed the delta was proportional to r at infinity. Then the indices would in fact be exactly those of the usual angular momentum, L plus 1, you know, that sort of thing. So this would be very similar to the normalizable, non-normalizable modes you'd be familiar with in ADS3. So a space that was not the space I'm looking at, that instead had delta proportional to r, would have a lot of nice normalizable, non-normalizable modes. I'd be able to consider all the stuff I do in ADS-CFT correspondence and basically change it. So that would be a nice geometry to look at. And this, in fact, is the right thing to do if I were in the BPS context. In the BPS context, I could basically take a new horizon limit that changes my delta to the one I actually have and cut off infinity and saying, there are modes out there, but they do not couple to my new horizon modes. And these two can be systematically separated. So what I really would like is to somehow do the same thing here. Separate the stuff far away from the stuff nearby. So what is the physical obstacle? Well, I could, for example, say, well, this delta here, I don't like the delta I'm stuck with. I like a different one. Well, one thing I could do, for example, would be to simply restrict to a region in which the delta is well approximated, the full delta is well approximated by the delta that I actually want. This I can do, but only if I decide to focus on particular black hole parameters. For example, if I tune my charges so that I go near extremality, indeed, I can justify that my full delta is approximated near the horizon by the delta that I like. In practice, what it corresponds to is that we are comparing two terms, this one here with that one here. Here, normally you'd say, well, actually this first term here kind of dominates near the horizon. We look at this term here versus that. This term here is the one that could mess up separability. This, on the other hand, is a term that sort of dominates near the horizon. Is one that has that blows up when x is 0. X is 0 is when we are at the horizon. So this is the near horizon term in the scalar equation. This is the far away term. And the strategy you would have by separating things between the near and the far is by saying, OK, near the horizon, this blows up. So clearly, that's important. And I should neglect that. And if I'm far away, I can neglect that and only pay attention to that. The problem is that this kind of decoupling of the near horizon geometry in asymptotic space, it simply fails if you're in a totally generic case. It's just never true that these terms here are simultaneously unimportant. It's always the case that these terms are somehow comparable with each other, because you're in a black hole where you have no tuning, where you've not made any scale bigger than some other scale. You just generically will say, well, look, these two things here, they have the same dimension, and if nothing is bigger than anything else, dimension analysis works, and these two are of the same size. I'm spelling this out because some people on the northeastern coast of the United States appear to think that one can approximate and simply throw away this term. I firmly deny that claim. It comes back with a periodicity of 1 year, but once, and has been for 15 years or 20 or something, but I mean, since before I entered physics, but when prominent people make it, it somehow seems to stick. It still doesn't make it true. These two terms are of the same order. And this is the one that dominates nearby the black hole. This is the one that dominates far away. And in the overlap region, they're equally important. And there's nowhere such thing that you can say, OK, let me just nicely take them one at a time. There's always a region where they're both important. I'm really sorry. It means that you cannot, in general, separate the near horizon from the far away. For example, it's been claimed sometimes that if you're just at low frequency, you can. That's a total lie. It's true that you can say at low frequency, this one here gives a very small number, and this one also gives a small number, at least if there's not too much angular dependence. And it's true that if 0 versus 0, they're both kind of small. It still doesn't mean that one of them is much smaller than the other. It just means that they're both negligible. And unfortunately, that means you're throwing away the entire black hole. When you go to low frequency, you see the entire black hole as if you have only a point. Not a good idea. You've lost all your structure. So this is all just a short story for what I think you should not do. Nevertheless, it's clearly the right thing to do. We just don't know why. So I have an alternative story. So let's just run with it. Let's proceed by just ignoring the offending term, right? I mean, if you have an argument and the argument is false, that's not good. Then it's better just to pretend. It's not a lot better, but at least it's better. So let's just try to ignore the terms that we don't like. And then I'll give you a story for why it was the right thing to do once we've seen what the result is. Then we indeed have a wave equation that's exactly SL2 Casimir. We can construct the generators, the L naughts, L plus minus, similar to with the Bard, and I've constructed all of them. I only give you the L naught and L naught Bard here. The point is that they are normalized. Because SL2 is a non-abelian algebra, I don't have a choice. If I just had some L naught generator that somehow was my time translation generator, I wouldn't know how to normalize it in the dual CFT. But once I have an SL2, I do know how. So I don't need my L plus and L minus very much, but I do need them to exist in order that I know how to normalize this one here. Because once I know how to normalize this one here, I know exactly how to find normalized conformal weights. I can find a normalized CFT temperature. Once I have the normalized CFT temperature, which was a pure number, I can compare it with the physical CFT temperature and find out how big is the circle, and therefore how big is the central charge, because I already knew the product of the central charge and the. So this is what I'll do. I'll compare the CFT central charge here with the physical one. I find the proportionality constant. That gives some stuff that's not immediately interesting. But you plug it back in the C times R that was previously discovered, and you find that the central charge is 12J. This is the same result that people had in the Kerr CFT. What is interesting here is that I did not go near extremal. What I'm saying is that it appears as if the Kerr CFT theory can accommodate all the other black holes as well. One just needs to put different charges on. But that central charge is what you need when you phenomenologically reconstruct and go backwards the way I've been trying to do in this talk. Right? I could, of course, have started with this and tried to go forwards, but that's not what I'll do. So this is the answer for the extreme black holes, right? And the reasoning I have followed, though, had nothing to do with extremality. And this pops out anyway. This, I think, is very interesting. Of course, there are numerous questions. Like, there were these terms that explicitly breaks SL2. What did I do with them? I ignored them. Not recommended procedure. This SL2, as I said, is extended to a Virasoro. How? Why? Good point. I should give you a story on that, right? And oh, this was all at the level of the wave equation. It was not actually the geometry. And in fact, in this previous story here, there's a thing about whether the periodicity, there seems to be some confusion here, whether it should be imaginary or real. Let me not get into that. But these first three questions here, I actually have answers to. And these are some of the central questions. So let me give you the answer. It requires that we look back at the solution and try to understand what this delta business that I really want to change, what it means. Let me try to rederive from the geometry here, rederive the causal structure and the thermodynamics. So here is the geometry, rewritten again now. It's really rewritten, not in a very complicated way. It's just that I used to have a dt with a shift up in front. Now I just put it in the back here instead. So exclusively moved just for the I to combine terms. This x here was some function of r, in fact, a quadratic function, such that it has two zeros. And it's those two zeros at the inner and outer horizon. I'm not going to particularly assume x is that quadratic polynomial. I'm just going to assume that x is some function of r. I'm not going to particularly take the g that is the real g. I'm just going to say there's some function that depends on whatever the x is, and then it has a little bit of theta dependence. And then these a phi and delta, let me just make them general functions of r and theta. So there's a class of metric that includes the geometry that I'm actually interested in. The reason I'm looking at this general class is that I'm trying to imagine what difference would it make if delta is not what it actually is, but is something else, because I have a favorite thing. Well, let me start finding the causal structure. Like, where is the ergosphere, the static limit? Well, the static limit I find by basically trying to, well, just be static, is where this that one term that has a minus sign in front, when that one becomes zero, when G is zero, then any ray must somehow move along some of this stuff. So therefore, G equals zero is the ergosphere. Similarly, I could ask, where's the event horizon? Well, that requires that I take the signature of this term times that term. And basically, it's the x is the signature that matters. Therefore, the event horizon is x equals zero. The event horizon is x equals zero. For this general class of metrics, well, I haven't really told you what x is. What's the thermodynamics of this thing? Well, I've worked it out. For this general class, I can find what is the rotational velocity, what's the Hawking temperature, what's the full entropy. Either of these things here is without actually specifying what this x function is, and without specifying this this delta that I had out in front. What is remarkable is not what these formulae are, is that there is no delta. I have not specified what delta is, yet I can give you correct expressions for all the thermodynamics. My thinking on that is that this somehow means that this delta doesn't have anything to do with the black hole. What it has to do with is that it encodes the boundary condition that I started with the assumption that my black hole was embedded into a space-time that was flat at infinity. What I clearly should do is to say, but I didn't mean that, because clearly in such a space-time I would have all sorts of excitations near infinity that have nothing to do with the black hole, and I should never try to count them and stuff like that. So that is why I have irregularities near infinity. I clearly should somehow delineate what is near my black hole and what is further away. This I do by plain and simple changing delta, and the way I interpret it is that I put my black hole in a box. In the good old days, people would say, good, good, you're right. In fact, it's really bad to have the Schwarzschild black hole or the Kerr black hole all by itself because, you know, it's negative specific heat, stuff like that. Really bad. You really should consider in a box. And which box should you take? Well, for lack of imagination, maybe something with Dirichlet conditions and stuff like that. And this is also complicated that, well, read some paper. You know, I won't do it, but I'll say the words. What I'm proposing is that we put it in a nicer box, not a Dirichlet condition box, but one that corresponds to changing delta from what it should be if you have asymptotically flat black holes to something that will preserve the conformal symmetry, as in put it in the unique box that is actually consistent with conformal symmetry. There's only a unique box that does that. It's that box you should choose. And don't worry. Changing which box it is in does not sort of change the black hole by itself. It only changes its environment. That's my interpretation of what happens, that the thermodynamics simply does not depend on the delta at all. If I don't know delta, I can even still do the integral and find the area of the black hole. I can even integrate over phi and theta. You know, phi is simple. It's just 2 pi. But the theta angle, the polar, you know, it's non-trivial. I can do the integral without knowing what delta is. It drops out everywhere. So this should give you, this should impress you. This should say, I mean, surely it sounded like he was just deluding himself and just imagining things. But the reason that I should imagine, and the reason I went this long way to say that the delta somehow, from one point of view, I felt I didn't like the delta we got and would like another one. Now I'm trying to argue more constructively that the delta, what it does for a living, is not telling me what the black hole is made out of. It is telling me in what environment does the black hole live. And of course, if you want to count the black hole by itself, you should put it in a very nice external environment that only includes sort of the black hole by itself. And in other words, have cut it off so that things don't escape to infinity where complicated things happen. So I've constructed a box for you by taking a different delta from the actual delta. So therefore, that's what I will do. I will simply take this delta and change it. If I further, for technicality reasons, assume that separability survives, and we have analyticity in R, no square roots and all that stuff, because then we create branch cuts and things. So basically, if the nice things sort of are preserved in the new delta, there's only a unique delta that I can have. This is the delta I should take. Still pretty complicated, but it's simpler. Previously, I had 2 or 3 lines. Now it's only 1 line. Still totally impenetrable, but you can see at large R, at least it goes like R. It doesn't go like R⁴ anymore. What? Oh, that's interesting. I think I have a slide on it. If not, a slide on it, but it's possible I forgot. But It's not a space-time I know. But it's not very complicated either. It has a good feel to it. It's a Lifshitz-like thing. So
why did you say this is a unique box? I mean, ADS is a box.
But it's a solution to the question.
Yeah, no, there are many questions here. So it's a solution. Wait with that I can answer. And I said that my interpretation here is that I'm allowed to change only. I have to keep my X and my G, because those things enter the thermodynamics. When you're putting it in a thermodynamic, in fact, as you said, the X, the thing whose zeros are the horizons. No, you are advocating that you get one that doesn't have two horizons, one that has three. It has a new thing. But this is why I'm saying this you are not allowed to do.
Okay.
I'm saying the rule here is that would change the thermodynamics in a way that is no doubt interesting, but it would sort of change it from one system to a different system since it has different thermodynamics. So this is not allowed, according to my rules. Alright? You're only allowed to change the delta, because that doesn't enter the thermodynamics, so only that is telling me what environment I'm in. The ADS black holes you're considering, I would say they're very interesting, but not only has the environment been changed, it's been changed including the stuff inside. That's why they're dual, perhaps, to not two-dimensional CFTs, but three and four and whatever CFTs, right? So they're interesting, but they're not the same black hole, I think. Then you said, does it still solve the equation of motion? Let me come to that in a second. No. So first let me just finish this slide. So what has been constructed here, at least is technically precise. Some people, they look at this wave equation and say, I don't like this term. Right? I was making fun of the Harvard group by saying that, well, so they claimed somehow that it could be approximated away. It was total bogus, I think. But okay, they disappeared somehow. I just pretended it wasn't there. What I've solved is the mathematical problem of saying, to which geometry is this wave equation without the offending term, the actual wave equation? As in, you start with a geometry, you invert it to find the wave equation. There's a term you don't like, and then you invert it back and say, what geometry is it for which I actually have a hypergeometric equation? So whether or not you think this is legitimate, well, this is the answer to that question. Okay? So that's a technical result. Did I have it there? Sure, I put it somewhere. Okay, maybe I put it on there. So I should answer Amir's question. So it is also true here that you say, okay, but you cheated because you had a solution. It really solved the equations of motion through the actual Einstein equation with the actual charges and stuff like that turned on. Now you decided that there was a delta you didn't like, so you changed it. But clearly what is on the right-hand side of Einstein's equation also needs change. My first line of defense would be to say, yes, you're right. Because you see, when you put it in a box, you have to make the box out of something. You know, you can't just make boxes just like that. You have to put in matter that supports the box. So you go and do this. Take my geometry, put it into Einstein's equation, figure out what's on the right-hand side, and whatever's on the right-hand side is the matter you need. And I don't frankly care, because it's nothing to do with the actual black hole, because the actual black hole is the stuff that's inside, it's not the box. Now, that's a bit abstract and a bit slick, so instead of waiting for you to do it, I actually did it, and did find out what matter should be on the right-hand side. I first checked that any energy condition you can possibly imagine, all of them, null, strong, all of them weak, are satisfied, so at least the matter's not crazy. And then we went one step beyond and actually found that there's a pretty simple construction of that extra matter that involves only a single vector field and a single scalar field, and it's perfectly nice. The next step after that of saying, okay, but how do you interpret that extra stuff? I think there's an interpretation, but that is not digested yet. But at least pursued along that direction does not lead you in terrible trouble, and that makes you feel good. It means that your reasoning, if your reasoning puts you in a corner, specific corner, and then that corner leads you in terrible trouble, you start questioning your reasoning. But when that corner leads further nice things, you say, maybe I'm onto something. Maybe you don't, but that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
In that box, does it have a positive specific?
That's a tricky question, because it depends on what time you're choosing. So the notion of energy is a bit tricky now, because remember, I used to have asymptotic space-time, where I had an actual mass and stuff like that. That space-time I've cut off. So
It was the other question that you're asking that's a better question, I think, which is my new asymptotic geometry. What is my notion of energy momentum in this new asymptotic geometry? This I would like to know, and I've not constructed it. Of course, it's possible. I mean, I have a system here that's diffeomorphism invariant. I can analyze the diffeomorphism group, find a subgroup that gives the energy momentum tensor act infinity, yada, yada, yada. I guess I've not done it yet.
Didn't you already make a choice, though, when you told me there was a temperature?
Yeah, no, that's right. I haven't digested it. Somehow the T I'm using is still the old T. It's just that you can't do that. Just because it's called T doesn't make it T, right? I mean, it's true that somehow I'm keeping the old one. But there's something there. There's some physics that I need to dig into a little bit more. And I think the best way to do it would be to construct an energy momentum tensor, basic following ADM kind of procedure. Except not asymptotic with that. No. So, but this I haven't done. But clearly, I mean, look, as soon as graduate admissions is over. So, one nice way of thinking about this stuff is to take my geometry, the one with the modified delta, and lift it up to five dimensions. Now, these black holes, I'm not necessarily thinking about as coming from a string theory origin. I'm saying somebody gave me a four-dimensional black hole, a curved black hole, whatever. I mean, perhaps it came from string theory, it certainly could be embedded into it, but it doesn't have to. So I'm thinking about it more phenomenologically. I'm saying, let me try to represent it in a nice way. In part, it's because I have these funny square root of deltas out in front, and they just don't look nice. It's a mess. So I like to lift them up, because these naturally come from the KK procedure in five dimensions. So I can represent things, these black holes, all of them, as black strings in five dimensions. And it turns out that if you actually take the metric, there still is a moderately complicated because it has all the same internal parts. It's only the delta that was a bit different. But it has all the stuff that you're familiar with from Kerr, and worse, because it's Kerr-Newman plus extra charges, you know, so quite a complicated moving parts. But if I lift that stuff to five dimensions, I actually end up with quite a lot fewer parts. Here I have this S here. It's really not the entropy. It's a shifted radial coordinate. But what is nice here is that in five dimensions, separability is manifest. So as I said before, you have to work a bit to see that separability of these rotating black holes was in fact separable. I mean, you have to work kind of hard to find it as a fact. Now I can demonstrate it for you directly in the geometry. And then if this alpha here, which is the fifth coordinate, you might say, this is a fake. Sure. Let me think about this as me doing a coset of a five-dimensional space-time. I'm going to mod out with the alpha again. But at least in this form, it's totally obvious that it's separable. But that's progress. There's a very nice form. There's a bonus to this procedure of lifting it to five dimension, which was that originally I had a scalar field equations that very nicely gave the SL2R generators. It was really the hypergeometric equation, and there was just a product of SL2 generators. But there was a problem that I was hiding to you, which was that, yes, it was an hypergeometric equation. It was an SL2R Casimir in the massless case. If you had a massive term in your Klein-Gordon equation, that massive term would be really complicated. In fact, it's saying that the massive equation does not separate variables. The massless one does. So if you take a massive scalar field in four dimensions and couple it minimally to the black hole geometry, the variables don't separate. Well, okay, maybe they're not so important, these massive scalars. What I can tell you now is that if you take a non-minimally coupled massive scalar, namely one that's minimally coupled to the 5D metric and then reduced down, that one does separate variables. So that's a nice extra bonus by going to the 5D point of view. Another nice point of view is that in this 5D geometry here, in fact, this is locally ADS3 cross S2. So I can construct Virasoro generators for you. So not only can I construct SL2 generators for you, I can construct Virasoro generators for you. And if you think that alpha here is not real, it's really just a joke, I would say, yes, at some level you're right. Therefore, the Virasoro is not a real Virasoro. You need a coset construction for this Virasoro. But still, to see everything transparently, you should lift up one dimension higher. So in this way, I think I've answered to sort of the key questions that my logic was leading me to and saying, yeah, but just because you're in SL2, do you really have a Virasoro? Apparently, yes. Just because you have separability for the mass-less equations, that's so impressive. Well, you got the massive for free, so looks nice. You know, this logic here seems to lead you to extra bonus points that were not put in, which makes you feel that the logic has something nice about it. A bad thing about it, though, is that this size R, that in fact was one of the things I really wanted to determine, because my phenomenological model from the very beginning found the central charge times R. And I want to know the central charge by itself. And for that, for example, I could compute R. But that gets hidden, actually, once I lift it to five dimensions, because now I have to introduce an additional mass, an additional dimension full parameter. And I do not know what it is. And basically, corresponding to that choice, I have an entire family of dual CFTs, and I do not know which one is right. So you get a lot of nice things, but you do not get everything that you were hoping for.
So what sets the ADS for you?
That's what I was saying.
Is that
what you're referring to? Yes. The ADS radius would be the same as the S2 radius, but I can't tell you what they are. I can embed, basically I'm saying I can embed the space-time I had in four dimensions into an ADS3 because S2 with any radius of the ADS3. What I do not have is a proposal for a physical principle that says which one of them should I pick. And somehow it sort of goes with the rules of the game. I mean, well, things are scale invariant, you know, then it's kind of hard to figure out what scales they are, you know. But yeah, so yeah, yes, so there should be a nice answer. I mean, there's a right way of doing it. I just do not know which the right way is, so I'm being honest. Unusual for me. I'm trying. So I hope that you see that I've been trying to give you a story. This is the end of the story. I could probably have squeezed in a few more details. I have several more minutes I could have used. But I've tried to give the talk in a slightly quirky way in a hope of making it more engaging. You know, having people think that I'm very wrong is a good start. It makes people not fall asleep. You know, it's better to be wrong than to be boring. And the highlights, the new things that in the end got put on the table were things like black hole thermodynamics were sort of reorganized. This is the way I was computing my black hole temperature, my area, was actually in sort of an indirect kind of way that was totally unique and correct, but it's not the way I normally would have done it. But it's because I had to somehow devise a way where I didn't have to use what delta was. And to my surprise, I could. It's not obvious that it was possible to do, but some of the direct ways that I normally would have used would have failed. But then some other ways, okay, no, it is determined fully what the thermodynamics is. And once I do that, I have this geometric construction, not just a scalar equation, but a geometric construction for a space-time to have an actual SL2. And then I have this lift to five dimensions that appear to show that this SL2 squared really is a Virasoro squared. And it's true that I don't know what size the Virasoro squared has, but I know all the generators. So somehow there's something right about this. And this is all, I remind you, in the case of totally general black holes, including, for example, Kerr with arbitrary mass and Engelmann. So thanks for your attention.
So I guess the claim here is that there is a correspondence between the number of degrees of freedom in a Kerr space-time and that of a one or two conformal field theory. Right?
A conformal field theory that's not chiral.
That's not chiral.
One that has so it's you can call it two chiral conformal field theories. So right and left movers that do not interact with each other.
So the correspondence, the evidence we have for it is first that just the entropy matching, and the second is the symmetry.
The second are the symmetries, that's right. The symmetry then has a loose end in that it doesn't really uniquely determine the central charge, so it's not everything we want.
But is it the symmetry of the symmetry of a scalar field that's propagating on this?
No, it's no longer, the scalar field is gone, right? I use the scalar field, look at the wave equation to guide my thoughts. But in the end, I said this is the geometry I'm interested in. Right, if you wish, you can put scalar fields in that geometry, but if you don't wish, don't. It's the geometry. The geometry has an SL2, it has killing tensors and symmetries and all that, all the good stuff. That's a feature of the geometry. So therefore, the scalar field is gone. I mean, it could be there, but...
I was just wondering whether that's enough to demonstrate correspondence, that you have the same symmetry and the same entropy.
Well... Enough is never enough, right? I mean,
you would want to show something maybe more concrete, that some calculation, some dynamical thing is the same on the two sides.
Yeah, but this,
I mean, certainly you would like that, but in the end here, I mean, look, the gold standard would be the ADS-CMT correspondency, right? Where you first, yes, you have some degrees of freedom and symmetry matching, but you also have various dynamical matching throughout all this. This is not at that level. But I'm not, maybe it could, maybe not. But at this point, I still think there's a conceptual picture, right? The ADS-CMT, to start establishing it, you don't compute four-point functions right away. You first understand things like scaling limits and stuff like that, and then you do all the good stuff, right? Here, I'm still at the first level of trying to understand what exactly should I claim? But I seem to have good cards on my hands to make various claims, some of which are hopefully correct, and some of them are probably not quite correct. It just depends a little bit. But I think I have good, good interrelated set of cards on hands that for making.
So that would be the next step for you to calculate the four-point function?
No, no, are you kidding me? No,
that's
no.
Too far.
I mean, it's look, as I say, to determine even just the sizes of these things that don't appear to be uniquely determined. I think that's because I'm somehow too slow, that I'm not consistent enough in saying, what are my symmetries? What do I care about and what do I not care about? And I have many things that I sort of like, but some of them I should say are important and some of them are not. Right? And I'm pretty not sharp enough on that. So the symmetries, I think, looks extremely promising, but and there's definitely something, but to clean that up, really, I don't think I have a. That's what it takes to even make a proposal that could be right. So far, it's just some symmetries that match with something else. Yeah. Amir?
Oh. Yeah, I'm not sure it makes sense, but let me ask you now. You try to support it with the dilaton?
We tried, and it doesn't quite work. It doesn't quite work. What works is that you need a scalar. But you need the KK scalar that comes down from five dimensions. And those couple, of course, it's just a scalar, but it's not just like a dilaton. The dilaton has a particular coupling in front of in front of a gauge field or whatever. This has a different coefficient. It's a different. So it looks similar to a dilaton, but I mean maybe there even is an alternate world where you could call the dilaton, I guess. I mean, dilatons, didn't they start out their life as the KK scalar that you get from five dimensions? So maybe I'm wrong when I'm saying that. Yeah, no, it's possible that I can, look, I have the actual matter. And I think about it as the KK mode coming from five dimension. That scalar was the thing I have to put in with the couplings that come from that. And in particular, I mean, I think about two stories. One is that maybe it's not important that I specify the matter in the first place. Maybe not. But I'm happy though that I can. And oh, now that it's so nice, maybe that's important too. That's why I'm saying that I have to admit my logic is not totally sharpened up, because when there are too many things I like and I don't have prejudices enough, then.
So in your new syntopic, does this kind of become linear?
No, I think it becomes constant. I think it becomes constant, but that's a good question. No, actually, that must be wrong, right? That must be wrong. No, that's not wrong. It's a good question. I don't know. I don't think so. I'm pretty sure it's not. But it's possible that that's just, there's some square roots and stuff like that in it, but it's possible that that's just because I'm not treating it as a dilaton like you would like me to do. There are funny powers in there, in the way that I'm representing them. And that I think is important. I think it means something about the scaling symmetry, just something I haven't appreciated. I'll be happy to show it to you on a board, at least some of these scaling symmetries there. And is it a linear dilaton? Yeah, no. I mean, I look for it. And found that it wasn't, but maybe it could. Maybe there's a way. The dilaton is not a totally unique object. Other questions?
Can you tell us what the asymptotic geometry looks like?
Yeah, I can. So it looks funny. So here there was this delta that was just r, and then there's some square root of deltas and stuff like that. So the best thing you should do is to rescale your r, with r being r to some power that I don't remember. But that power has been constructed in such a way that I get a nice dr squared with a 1 in front. It turns out that when I do that, I also get basically an entire three-dimensional space, very nice. Now comes the funny thing. I have a dt term with an r to the 6 in front. and a scale down here that is whatever it takes. That's the asymptotic behavior. And you can see why I sort of think it looks reminiscent of Lipschitz. It's not Lipschitz, but it's reminiscent of that. If I have an obvious rigid scaling symmetry where I rescale time and R, but involve this cubic stuff. And this has to do with the fact that this central charge somehow likes to be cubic in the mass. And so it's related to that, but I haven't nailed the as in related. Yeah, I can only do the sort of stupid rigid geometry. Clearly somehow I should be able to take advantage of some diffeomorphism sort of thing. But still, it's a systematic exercise to say, okay, that's great. You have a space time like this, plus dot 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 means subleading. Well, what diffeomorphisms are allowed? Well, for that I need to specify a little bit more precisely what I meant by the dot dot dot. But hopefully one can find a certain subgroup of the diffeomorphism that close upon itself and stuff like that, and that may transform the leading subleading terms into themselves, and this would actually realize the incremental tensor and stuff like that. At any rate, that would be an excellent thing to do. If this was ADS, that would work very well. If it was a asymptotic curve, it would work very well. The net geometry, in this case, I have not tried very hard, and my postdoc has not managed.
If there are not further questions, let's thank SB.